Hello again, listeners. This is Todd Maxwell, a member of the Bureau of Justice Assistance Body-Worn Camera Team, and today I'm speaking with Jessica Minley, National Director of Training and Technical Assistance at Victim Rights Law Center. Jessica Minley directs both the Victim Rights Law Center's National Technical Assistance Efforts and the Victim Rights Law Center's Oregon Office, which provides free legal services to sexual assault survivors. Jessica has trained thousands of advocates, lawyers, healthcare professionals, law enforcement, and other service providers across the U.S. on how to effectively identify and use the law to meet sexual assault survivors' most urgent needs. Her expertise on privacy issues for survivors has been recognized by the Office on Violence Against Women and the Office for Victims of Crime. Jessica has also presented trainings and workshops to the U.S. military, the National Assembly of Suriname, and to NGOs and government officials in northern Iraq. Jessica serves as an adjunct professor of law at both Lewis and Clark and Louisiana State University Law Schools. She's been active in the movement in gendered violence since the 1970s. Jessica, thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you for this opportunity.
And let's go ahead and get started, unless you had any opening remarks.
Nope. Go ahead, and I'll just follow.
Okay. And you work with sexual assault survivors and victims. What would you say is the biggest fear around BWCs?
So I want to start off by just saying that, on the one hand, I don't think the concerns are the same for every sexual assault survivor in every community. And, of course, I don't speak for all sexual assault survivors. That said, I've worked with both thousands of survivors and also the victim service providers. And I think particularly with respect to body-worn cameras and the discussion happening right now, there's certainly a recognition that there's some very good things that come from the use of body-worn cameras or BWCs. And particularly, I mean, we spoke earlier acknowledging the headlines today that as we've seen, that there's lots of concern in communities of color around law enforcement and the shootings that have happened, and that there's a need for transparency and to promote trust both in safety for law enforcement as well as for the communities that they serve. That said, I think for survivors, there's great concern around the actual and potential breach of privacy that results from the use of cameras. And it's a tension that we need to resolve, that we need to make informed decisions going forward. I mean, oftentimes, depending on the laws of a specific state or territory, that the recordings may be being made by law enforcement without a victim's knowledge, without a victim's consent to the recording being made, and perhaps limited, if no, understanding on what will happen with that recording afterwards. Certainly when victims call 911 to report a sexual assault, you know, whether that report's being made immediately following the assault or in the hours, days, or even weeks, months, or years later, survivors are typically unaware of what may happen, what are the possibilities of what will happen to the information that they share. And certainly in that sort of recent post-assault period, it may not ever occur for them to ask questions such as, with whom is this information going to be shared? Is there a recording being made, and what will happen to it? I'm providing all of this personal information. Will the person who raped me have access to my address and my phone number, to the statements that I'm making, to information about where I work if I'm providing that? And certainly they're not thinking about what it might mean to have not just the person who assaulted them, but friends or family members or judges or jurors or even just the public at large, anybody, be able to access that recording of them. And it may be victims who are describing injuries that they sustained. They may be only partially clothed or even unclothed. I think we've really sort of let the technology get ahead of us, and survivors are understandably and very justifiably concerned about losing any kind of control or having any kind of input as to what happens once they reach out for help. And these are just, I think, some of the examples I just gave of victims who chose to call law enforcement. And certainly we know that with mandatory reporting laws, there may be victims who are minors or adults who have a disability or an older adult where somebody else may have made the report to law enforcement on their behalf, either consistent with or over their wishes or over their objections. And for those survivors, there's even less of any input into the decision or access to have an understanding of what may happen with the recording that is being made. Sexual assault survivors tell us that one of the number one reasons they don't report a sexual assault to law enforcement is their fear and their concerns around their privacy being compromised. They're more concerned about friends or family or coworkers finding out about the rape or the sexual assault than they are concerned about getting pregnant, getting a sexually transmitted infection. You know, we know that video and visuals and audio are very powerful. And they're powerful for the community, they're powerful for triers of fact, and they're powerful for the victims themselves. And unfortunately, they are not always handled in a survivor-centered way. I mean, I remember a case a number of years ago that I was tangentially involved with and helping with, where the perpetrators actually made a recording. They videotaped themselves as they assaulted this woman. It was multiple perpetrators. And the judge was ordering this victim that she was going to have to watch a video of herself being raped. And she refused, and the prosecutor was absolutely adamant that she should have to watch it. And the judge threatened to hold her in contempt. And the victim said, I'm not watching it. I have no memory of what happened to me. I don't want to have to watch a video of myself being raped. And that's always stayed with me about the power that these recordings have. And obviously in this case, we're not talking about videos of victims being raped, but rather of their interviews in which they're recounting what happened to them.
Right. So how would you suggest a law enforcement agency balance a victim's right to privacy with the need to capture information using either a body-worn camera or other type of recording device for evidence in court cases? Because it's becoming the practice now that judges and prosecutors are expecting this type of video and audio evidence.
Well, I the first part of, for me is that I think victims should be made aware, number one, when a recording is being made, and certainly in jurisdictions where, you know, two-party consent is required, their consent should be secured before it's being made. I think we, in many respects, we have the technology that really has gotten ahead of any kind of critical conversation in terms of what are we doing with that technology, how are we using it. You know, information can be captured in so many different formats. And yes, it may enhance the prosecution for witness or victim statement to be on video, but it also may be powerful to have photographs, to have audio without the visuals, that we have all collectively played a part in creating these expectations, and I think there's a way in which we can ratchet them back down. We can do public education around, just as this podcast is, for trying to enhance understanding of why a victim may choose not to have his or her image being recorded, or they may want to give statements rather than the audio recording. We also need to recognize that once that information is out there, it can be used to further victimize the survivor. You know, just recently I was involved with a case where the perpetrator got access to the victim's medical records, and he and his family members shared them with dozens of other people. And if I think helping certainly triers of fact understand, if this were you, you wouldn't want this video public on the internet or on the television stations, et cetera, to try and reframe expectations.
Right. Well, earlier you mentioned the next question sort of goes around advising the police department to develop their policy and what coordination is like. And I know you mentioned advising the victims that they were going to be recording and give them the option to turn it off. But could you elaborate maybe some more on the different important advocacy issues that they should consider for their policy development?
Well, there are certainly a lot of different factors to consider. I think we've really found ourselves in a situation where we have put the cart before the horse and begun to use these video cameras without policies, without protocols, without public awareness campaigns in place. I've done this work for almost 40 years, and from the outset, and remain to really believe in the value of providing survivor-centered response to sexual assault or to domestic violence. And information is power. And I think that we need to have some power with these really unique personal crimes being returned to the victims themselves. So, as I mentioned earlier, victims being informed in advance that the interview will be recorded and ideally given a choice of whether the camera is on voice, whether it's on visual, whether it's on both. We need policies that address who has access to that tape. Is it turned over to, for example, the defendant? What if a defendant is representing him or herself, in other words, proceeding pro se? Do they actually get given the physical tape? Are they allowed to go somewhere to view it? How do we balance that in terms of defendant's rights? Will the victim be able to get a copy of the video, him or herself? You know, we know that a lot of sexual assault reports, for example, don't go forward. The prosecution doesn't go forward. What if you have victims who are interested in a civil case? Can they get access to it? Does it determine, does it rest on whether or not there's been a conviction? If you have a victim who's a minor, who decides whether or not that victim may be recorded? Is there a certain age cutoff? Do you look to, like, the mature minor doctrine, where it's typically, you know, around the age of 14, there's increasing agency for the individual? Is it a parent? Is it a guardian? Does the court decide? When is that decision made? How do you, obviously, you know, through responding police officers, you need to have a policy that they can implement right there on the spot. Does the victim have a choice to say, I want you to shut the camera off now? And do we educate them on what implications that may have in the context if there is going to be a criminal case? You know, there are some jurisdictions where the cameras are on from the time that the officer starts work until the end of the shift, and that means it's on as they walk through emergency room, waiting rooms. What happens when they go in there? Some jurisdictions, officers are at the hospital, and they're actually in the room when a medical forensic exam is being conducted. I don't think that's a good practice. Are we taping somebody's medical examination? Who's captured on the video? Is it just the individual victim? Is it the support person, family members, medical personnel? And then, of course, the critical issue of who gets access to that video. Is it the general public? Are there any limitations that are going to be put in place under the law? How do you get it taken down if it's improperly put up? You know, we've really sort of started using these cameras and making these recordings without fully thinking through what's the impact, what are the implications, and what policies need to be in place before we're implement. They should have been in place before we started using them.
Yeah, and that sort of leads to our next question, which is about FOIA laws, and many states have these sunshine laws that dictate open records to the public. So how does that conflict with the victim or survivors that want to have a voice and whether the video should be made publicly available to limit the victimization again?
Well, it's a direct conflict, and again, I think it's a great example of where we began to use the technology without hitting the pause button, which is what we should have done, to say what laws are in place, are there laws that need to be changed, are there policies that need to be changed, and then trying to affect those changes before we began using the body-worn cameras. And as you note in the question, there are states or territories where the sunshine laws require any police recording be made available, anything in their possession. And I think if victims were fully aware of this, it would have a tremendous negative impact on survivors' willingness to call law enforcement to report crime, and that in turn would have a negative impact on the safety of our communities for everyone. So I think we need to, you know, again, sort of what I would like to see is hitting that pause button and looking for each jurisdiction. What are the laws in my state or my tribe or my territory? How do they implicate the use of body-worn cameras? And then involving the community to decide what are the policies going to be given what the state of the law is, or do we need to change the law?
This concludes today's podcast with Jessica Mindlin, National Director of Training and Technical Assistance at Victim Rights Law Center.